It said that the ancient philosophers, or one or some of them, said that only philosophers are real people, and everybody else is akin to a painted figure that does not truly exist. Now, it might seem presumptuous to even consider such a proposition, insofar as every individual is liable to view him or herself, say, as a participant in some or another profession or activity, as being really the only real person. For example, only if you are in my tribe, then you're truly human. That tribe over there is not truly human. Only if you're a musician, not to pick anything out, just an example, musician like me, then you're really a person. If you're not a musician, you're not really a person. Only if you're an artist, you can appreciate aesthetic things, then you know, you deserve the title of human being. If not, you don't. So from that perspective, obviously, any such, again, presumptuous superiority can be dismissed. And yet, it can still perhaps be worthwhile to think about whether or not that can have a point, right? Why would somebody say such a thing? So, as it concerns that question, it can perhaps be transfigured into the question of the relation of thought, insofar as presumably it was meant that a philosopher, being somebody that thinks at a high level, is thought necessary to be human, to truly be existent and living? Right? And what sort of thought, and to what extent, and in which way? Perhaps we can begin with an analogy by taking what is immediately evident to our senses, that being the body. And we can take, say, an extreme example of physical and or athletic, should that differ, development, such as a professional bodybuilder, an elite athlete. And we can compare that state of the anatomy with that which that very same person had some years prior when he or she was born, and which all newborns have. How do you go from, again, the little bundle of joy that is born and yet is entirely helpless and weak and frail and susceptible to the slightest kind of stimuli, negative stimuli, such as even 5 pounds is certainly probably too much for a newborn, even 1 pound maybe. Yeah, probably, certainly, right? Depending on their size, maybe. To a professional athlete, to a chiseled bodybuilder, where every muscle can be seen. One way to describe that process would be one of growth and adaptation, obviously. And we could ask, what are the necessary conditions for such growth and adaptation to occur? One would be, of course, the initial presence of a body. If I'm thinking of my future children, that I imagine now, they can't play sports or bodybuild because they quote unquote, don't have a body. Right? They don't exist yet, except as ideas in my head, for whatever that's worth. Now, so they do need to have a body. There does need to be a body present. Next, the body needs to not have any prohibitive problems, such as would prevent it from adapting to stimuli. For instance, there are babies born with different sorts of, unfortunately, tragically, diseases that can prevent any growth, any substantial growth, and several years later, the baby body is almost the same or sufficiently similar to that which it was like when it was born. Not that the baby is it, the body is it. Right? There can be, say, different sorts of disorders, muscle wasting disorders, paralysis, all kinds of issues that would prevent any such adaptive process from occurring. But rolling that out, we have now a real body that really does exist and it doesn't have any of those problems. Next, there would need to be sufficient stimuli to permit or to evoke, say, such adaptation. To some extent, those stimuli are there no matter what. Right, just from the first few years of birth and then puberty and such. But past a certain point, certainly to become an elite athlete, a very muscular individual, that stem line needs to be kind of put in place, especially for that purpose. I need to expose myself to greater and greater weights, to greater and greater opportunities to exercise power, such as jumping and running and so forth. Opportunities to develop hand-eye coordination, agility, balance. Those stimuli need to be imposed onto the body. And insofar as desire is needed for that, there needs to be that desire, right? I may have the best gym and the best trainers and the best athletic programs right near me, but if I don't want to partake in them, that stimuli shall not influence me. So the three conditions then again are, I need a body. The body needs to be able to change. It has to not have any sufficiently severe problems that would prevent it from change. And then stimuli needs to be, the body needs to be exposed to stimuli such as will force it to adapt. And if that is done at a sufficiently high level, if there's enough ability in the first place and there's enough effort put in, that can yield, an elite athlete, a professional athlete, a bodybuilder and such. Now, that's good for what it's worth. But now what if we were to take that as an analogy for individuality, for the development of persons? And should one say there's no difference between the development of the anatomy and the development of persons, the two being one and the same thing? Setting aside any intricate technical issues, the mind, the body, the mind-body problem, this and that, can simply be said that certainly I can grow my muscles without growing my mind. Right? I can become super competent in the weight room, and yet I can't even solve a simple math problem or say a simple sentence or understand a simple sentence, whatever the case might be. So at least in that evident and obvious apparent way, we can still think about the differences between the development of the anatomy and the development of whatever extra element there is such that would constitute integral human development. So again, taking the bodily development as an analogy, we can ask, what are the conditions that are needed in order for a person to grow into his or her full stature? And it would seem to be the same thing. There needs to be a person or a mind or an individuality, such as we infer is present should we see a baby body that is living. If I see, for example, a stone, I have no grounds to suppose whatsoever that there is any sort of mind or individuality, quote unquote, behind that stone or that which that stone indicates. Right? It's just a stone, it's just an appearance. If I'm chatting with the AI, I have no grounds to suppose that there's anything but appearances as it concerns that AI, amazingly, magically, constructed. It's incredible what the technology can do, but all the same, just appearances, just stuff. However, if I see a baby body that is living, then I do have grounds to assume that I ought to infer the presence of a real mind, a real individuality, such that is other than my own. So that's the first step. There needs to be a person present, or the possibility of personhood present. Two, there needs to be no, likewise as with the body, prohibitive problems that would preclude the growth of that individuality. For example, if a baby is born with a degree of brain tissue missing past a certain point, then development may not be forthcoming, right? Which is not guaranteed, perhaps, because there are instances of babies being born with a tiny amount of brain tissue, which then grows back, right? Or even individuals that are missing most of their brain that still can function, and certainly half a hemisphere is oftentimes no problem at all if it's missing. But say, if there's only a brain stem, as it concerns a given baby, we can set that aside. Right? Also, if there's severe intellectual disabilities such that would not permit the baby to learn a language, to acquire any ideas, we can set those cases aside as outliers. If, however, there is, within a vast normative range, the possibility of change, of growth, of adaptation by the way of the mind, by the way of the individuality, that would be the next condition. And lastly, there need to be stimuli such as are imposed onto the mind or such as that the mind is exposed to. Now, what is the nature of that stimuli here? As it concerns the body, the stimuli are obvious or can be immediately apparent. Weights, long distances, the pool, I swim, I get used to swimming. I run, I get used to running. I lift weights, I get used to running weights. I box, I get used to being punched in the face. I wrestle and grapple, I get used to being taken down and hopefully getting some takedowns of my own. What are the commensurate elements as it concerns mind and individuality? And here, a broad general word would be truth. It would be simply reality, albeit such as only the mind is able to apprehend and not just the body considered in isolation. What are obvious examples of such realities to make sure it's not just chitter-chatter that we mean? Well, for example, math, right, is a classic example of truths, right, that the body cannot apprehend. I can't adapt my muscle to geometrical numerical propositions. All right, let me get a good pump in by thinking about 2 times 2 is 4. 10 times 10 is 100. Not going to work. Obviously, I can count physical things that I do, and that can have the influence, but it wouldn't be the math per se. It would be that which I'm counting. So, again, the body can't apprehend mathematical propositions, but something such as we can call the mind or the self can. For instance, why is 2 plus 2 4? Well, if by 2 we mean a single group consistent of a single demarcation in abstract, right? Meaning a single this as opposed to that in abstract, not anything specific like this tree or this cow or this house, but just in general, the idea that you can set one thing aside from another. So 2 would be a single group consistent of a demarcation and a demarcation. The other 2 would be consistent of another, or the other term 2 would refer to the other group consistent of a like demarcation and a demarcation. The plus sign implies or is an instruction to combine those present elements. The equal sign asks us what is then resultant. And the answer, as a matter of necessity and tautology, is a demarcation, and a demarcation, and a demarcation. In other words, what we call 4 as a shorthand. Right, that's a reality. That's true. It cannot be anything other than true, even though if we weren't to apply these abstractions onto perceptual elements, such as water drops, for example, then things could be different. But then it's just that that would not be a correct application, meaning somebody could say, no, it's not necessary, to make it a little easier, that 1 plus 1 is 2, because if you take a water drop and a water drop, you're just going to have one water drop, right? So there's an exception. It's not an exception, because the equation 1 and 1 equals 2 presupposes that the elements involved retain their demarcation, retain their individuality. 2 would be a group of the individual one and the individual one that retain their individuality simultaneously to being part of a single group. For instance, I can put an apple and an apple into my bag. That doesn't get rid of their individual applehood. I can take them out then and eat one apple and then save the other one for later. It's just that for the time being, they're in a single group in my bag. All right, so the equation again, 1 plus 1 presupposes that that individuality is retained while combining the individualities in a single group. Should such an equation should be attempted to be applied to perceptual elements such as water drops, such that do not retain their individuality, then it's just the wrong application of that equation, right? 1 plus 1 equals 2 does not then describe water drops, because upon combination, they cease to retain their individuality, so it's something different than 1 plus 1 equals 2. 1 plus 1 equals 2 in abstract is true by necessity. It's a tautology. It must so be. Again, this is a truth, however, that, or the aforementioned 2 plus 2 equals 4, these are truths that the body conceived independently, again, as muscles, as tendons, as ligaments, as the lungs, can make no use of. It cannot understand it. It cannot adapt itself in relation to these truths. And yet something that we tend to call the mind can adapt itself to such realities. I can be taught, again, considered from the perspective of mind or intellect or whatever we would say, I can be taught these mathematical truths. I can be taught that 1 and 1 equals 2, or that 2 times 2 equals 4. And therefore, I can go from ignorance to knowledge. I can adapt myself to these realities, to these truths. It seems that simultaneously, these truths, such as the mathematical ones, are not subjective in the sense of I'm just saying whatever I please. In that case, it's not true. It's just yapping. Right? I can say 1 plus 1 equals blah, blah, blah. 1 plus 1 equals 87, just because I like that number, right? Whatever it might be, that's not truth. Truth is me as an individual mind following the necessity that it really exists in reality. It really is so that when you combine 1 and 1, you get 2, and I'm following that out in my mind. So it's an individual, quote-unquote, subjective, just because it is individual, a phenomenon, but it's in relation to what is objective, what is truly true. And so, for example, if we take the question of what is the population of such and such town, we hold that there is a true answer. There is a correct answer. It's not anything. Right? The answer is not, you know, what I pull out of a hat, unless by coincidence I pulled the correct answer out of a hat. There's a correct answer, but it needs to be attained to. I do need to count. And prior to, in my mind, forming this group, residents of this town, and then undertaking the steps necessary to yield the proper number in that group, such as by counting, going around to each house and counting a poll, however it would be done. Those realities, it seems so, don't exist as those realities. That number is in nobody's mind until it has been generated. Right? Let's say nobody knows how many people live in town X. Nobody does know that. There is no such number considered as a number, right, prior to it being generated. But in generating it, we don't simply, again, say something according to our whims, if we're honest. Certainly somebody could. I'm going to pretend I did a census, but not actually do it. We are trying to conform our individual minds, our individual knowledge and understanding to reality, such as is what it is, such as is what we can call objective and actual. Now, insofar as that is so, it can be asked, is truth limited to such simple propositions as that 1 and 1 is 2 or 2 times 2 equals 4? There's no reason to suppose so. By the term truth, we can mean the entirety of reality as it is. And by the term truth, as it concerns individual minds or thought, then we could say we can mean the conformity of individual minds to truth as it really exists. Now, again, taking the analogy of the body, anatomical developments could be considered as the adaptation, the development of individual bodies to stimuli such as our objective. If I go to an imaginary weight room and I lift imaginary weights, I run imaginary miles, I will not adapt my body to those stimuli. It needs to be a real weight room, or at least real weights and real miles and a real swimming pool if I want to swim, right? And so forth. So I'm taking, again, the subjective, the individual, I'm adapting it to the objective, to the actual. That's really 50 pounds. That's really a mile. And then I want to conform myself to those realities physically. So as it concerns individuality and intellect, it would seem, at least, to be the same idea. Reality is what it is, but it's on me to conform myself as an individual private mind to that reality, best as I'm able to. And the conditions for that would be, just as with the body, the existence of a mind, no absolutely prohibitive problems to its development, to its adaptation, and then the presence of stimuli such that the mind can adapt to. And that stimuli would be called, as was suggested, reality, but when we apprehend it, we can call it thought, we can call it ideas. And so again, take that simple example, that 1 plus 1 equals 2, we say, is a reality. But insofar as I individually apprehend it and think about it, we can call it thought. We can call it an idea in my mind of, in reference to, reality such as is what it is. Now, with that said, we can turn again to the initial question, which would be something like, insofar as, again, ancient philosophers claim that only philosophers can be real and other people are like painted figures, meaning not real, they come and they go. We can ask, in light of some of the suggestions offered, how would we go about thinking about that problem? Well, physically, in order to exist, again, I need to have a body. And for my body to be anything worthwhile, it needs to adapt itself to realities applicable to it. Right? Obviously, here I have great genetics, as it's called. I can still be decent physically without much work. But aside from that, and even with that, that's to a limited extent. Ultimately, I need to do some working out, hopefully, and I need to build up a physique. Right? Again, puberty can do some of the job for me, but we see the physique of a baby is not much to speak of. It exists, right? But compared to what it can be in 18 years, 20 years, whatever it might be, more or less, it's not too much to speak of. So here, again, taking that as an analogy, we could say perhaps that in order for me to exist as a real individual, right, as a genuine human personality, several conditions need to be met. First of all, there needs to be, say, the seed of what I could be present, right? For an oak tree to ever be, first there needs to be a seed of an oak tree. Just so for any possible humanity and personality and personhood that can be attained to be, first there needs to be that seed, which would be the baby, right? Again, an imaginary child, it won't do the trick. An imaginary person won't do the trick. There needs to be a real baby. Second, in order for me to attain to what I could attain to as a principle of individuality, as a person, I need to not have any absolutely prohibitive issues that can preclude my growth, my adaptation to reality. But let's say that there's no such issues. What then is needed? Well, I need to expose myself to reality, such as in my own individual mind can be called ideas, which is not then to suggest that they're quote-unquote subjective in the sense of just nonsense and whatever I feel like yapping. I need to expose myself to reality, for me, which is thought and ideas. And I need to adapt myself to that reality. And the idea would seem to be, or an idea that seems supportable, would be that only past a certain such degree of adaptation do I have any coherent individuality, any kind of a sufficient integration such that could really be called real personhood. And prior to that, potential. Right? So again, a baby has the potential to one day be a great athlete and have a pretty decent physique, right? Should there not be any prohibitive issues. But the work needs to be put in. It's not going to happen to that extent by itself. Just so, it seems then, the baby has the potential to be a real person, to be an integrated human personality. Again, assuming there's no prohibitive issues. Assuming that a sufficient adaptation to reality, such as, again, we call ideas and thought in our mind, occurs. And that process of adaptation could be called education, or it could be called the pursuit of truth, or it could be called thinking, whatever we call it, philosophizing in a certain sense that is obviously completely different from the usual sense of the term, as in I'm going to, you know, read the book and think about the syllogism and the argument and this and that. Right? But whatever we would call it, that is a process that seems necessary, right, in order for personality to develop. And again, precluding such a process, precluding such an adaptation, I have the possibility to be a person. The seed of what I could be is there, but it's not going to be realized. And therefore, instead of being a kind of an individual in the fullest connotation of the term, I can be thought of more as just the sort of psychophysiological center in which certain desires and impulses and appetites arise, right, and then go away and then arise again. I want this and I want that, and This is what brings me pleasure, and this is what brings me pain, and this is my fantasy, and this is my imagination, and so forth, and so on. I am just like, again, a body prior to being adapted to physical stimuli is real. It exists. Everybody has a body. But it won't be able to perform the function of an athlete, worth the title, say. And it won't be able to do what it could do were it to be worked on. Just so here, I exist as a potential individual. I exist in the capacity of sentience, in the capacity of intelligence. Certainly, I'm a real person. But unless I take to the duty of being human, I take on the human yoke and I think and pursue the truth, I cannot perform the duties of a human being. I cannot really love. I cannot really reason. And also, I cannot really exist as an individual. Or so the argument would go. So, concerning the initial question, is it true that only philosophers, quote-unquote, as the term was used in ancient times, meaning pursuers of the truth, is it true that only pursuers of the truth exist and everybody else is as a painted figure that does not really exist? In light of some of the suggestions made as to the nature of reality, it could be thought that just as everybody has a body, everybody has a self in the sense of sentience, in the self, of self-activity and such. And yet, just as it is necessary to expose the body to sufficient stimuli in order for the body to be able to perform as an athlete, right, to do physical things past a certain minimal point, so too the potential personhood, the potential individuality, the mind needs to be exposed to reality in order to become what it can be, in order to attain to any real lasting permanency as an individuated aspect of reality. That reality, when it is, when we interface with it, we call thought, we call ideas, but not in the sense of it being subjective in some kind of crude sense. You know, I'm just like imagining things and fantasizing about the thoughts and the unicorns and the fantasies. No, in the sense of dutifully pursuing reality and necessity wherever it leads me. Where does 1 + 1 lead me? Let me think. Well, it leads me to 2. All right, that's true. That's a fact. It's not because my name is Bob or Beal or Jane or Alice that is so. It is so because it is so. It is so for all. But that so-ness, that reality was just reproduced in this individual mind, such as is called Bob or Beal or Jane or Ellis. And that's what we can call a thought, an idea. But it is as it concerns. It is in light of truth. So, in short, it does seem that truth is needed to become real. Truth is needed to become a real person and not just a human animal, a sort of temporary center where different impulses arise and pass away. By pursuing the truth, by using our human potentialities to the best of our ability, we not only hopefully can, sound smart or be thought of as educated or whatnot and very, you know, philosophical, but we can, in fact, attain to actual being. We can begin to truly exist past a certain point of development, past a certain point of individuation, we can call it, past a certain point of adaptation to reality, we can attain to a being such that is other than a mere transient kind of little blur that comes and goes. Or so, again, some would argue, such as said ancient philosophers that claim that only the pursuers of truth truly exist and others do not. So we can think about it. Thank you for listening.